the autumn of 1948, a few dozen young people set off across the world to broaden their horizons. About 40 Americans and a similar number from China, Burma and the Philippines, the first participants in a new scholar exchange program.
And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way.
It was the era when Nat King Cole's hit Nature Boy dominated the charts, perhaps music they heard on their journeys. But in any case, they were all keen to listen and learn from the people in the far-off countries they were travelling to. For that was the guiding principle of what is now one of the largest academic exchange programmes in the world, the Fulbright Scholarship Programme, named after James William Fulbright, the American senator whose original idea it was. I'm Bridget Kendall, and today on the Forum from the BBC World Service, we're going to trace the history and impact of the Fulbright and other international scholarships. And I'm joined by four people who are all former Fulbright scholars. Fulbright biographer Randall Woods, Professor of History at the University of Arkansas in the United States. Joan Darson, Professor of International Education and Development at Brandeis University in Massachusetts. And two recent Fulbright scholarship recipients, language teaching specialist Vitória Proche from southern Brazil and Niloufar Sahi, a human rights activist from Afghanistan. Welcome to all four of you. And let's begin at the beginning of the Fulbright programme. Randall, very briefly, fill us in on why Fulbright started it.
Well, he was a member of the United States Senate at the close of World War II. He was horrified by the massive destruction of the war, by the Holocaust, by Hiroshima. He believed that in an atomic age, the world could not afford another great power conflict. And he believed that nationalism and xenophobia, both economic and strategic, had been responsible for World War II and past wars. And therefore, he wanted to establish an international educational exchange program in which students and scholars from around the world would visit the U.S. and from the U.S. to other parts of the world. It would create understanding and empathy and reduce dramatically the possibility of another great power conflict.
Let's listen to how Senator Fulbright himself later recalled the beginnings of the program.
In 1943, when I first came to the House of Representatives, the first bill that I introduced, the first piece of legislation, was a resolution that with regard to the creation of the United Nations. And then following that, you see in 45, 2 years later, when the end of the war occurred in August, these things would get in your mind, and it occurred to me that in order to create a constituency for the concept of the United Nations, we needed a program of this kind in which the people from all over the world who would be the constituents of the United Nations could come to know one another, to understand and to respect the traditions and cultures and values of other people, and this was necessary to make the idea of the United Nations function.
And how did he set it up? How was it organized?
Isolationism and xenophobia were still the main characteristics of American culture and its views on toward other nations. He understood at first that conservatives would not support spending U.S. tax money on this. So what he proposed was the use of the sale of lend-lease items abroad. The U.S. had spent billions of dollars buying supplies for our allies. About $100 million worth of those supplies were still in warehouses in those countries. American manufacturers did not want them back in this country to compete. And so Fulbright suggested that those items be sold and the proceeds given to the host countries to be used to finance foreign exchange programs. And he subsequently persuaded Congress to pass legislation creating a board of foreign scholarships to supervise the program in this country. And the first of what would become over 60 bilateral agreements were signed in 1946.
And this wasn't the only scholarship around at the time. Joan, what were other scholarships like at that time?
Right. Before answering, I would just like to push back a bit against this notion that there was a vision of pure internationalism at the basis of the Fulbright program. That was also a moment when the U.S. was the victor, obviously, in the Second World War, and that the exchanges had a clear nationalist flavor in the sense that foreigners in the U.S. would absorb our culture, but Americans abroad would also spread it overseas. I think it's important to see the nationalist assumptions that were also involved in the creation of the whole multilateral system, including the World Bank, the IMF, and other institutions developed at the time. So you see these national interests in other programs that were founded around the same time, if not in the immediate post-war period, a little bit later on. For example, the Commonwealth Scholarships began in 1960, and they are very interesting to compare with the Fulbright program. This was the time of the beginnings of rapid decolonization, and so the Commonwealth scheme, the scholarship scheme, was really a reflection of the aspirations of the Commonwealth as a partnership of independent states. And the structure, the very decentralized structure with lots of bilateral agreements, was actually very much the same mechanism that the Commonwealth scholarships established. The Rhodes Scholarship, also probably still the most prestigious scholarship in the world, or the one with the most name recognition, had been operating since 1903. Based in the UK, based at Oxford, and Senator Fulbright himself, as was Bill Clinton later on, was a Rhodes Scholar. And I think what's interesting, if you look at these programs, they embrace the contradictions, in a sense, of nationalism, what came to be called soft power to promote influence of the sponsoring government. You see a similar thing with the German Exchange Service, which was founded back in 1925. More than 2 million scholars have benefited from those programs, much more than the total number of Fulbrighters, by the way. And so you see many different kinds of scholarships emerge in this period with a variety of motives and interests.
Randall, Joan mentioned the fact of many bilateral agreements. Why was it that the Fulbright was set up so that there were these dozens of separate agreements between the American government and individual governments of other countries?
Well, I think the idea was to create a constituency in those countries. There would be a commission in each of the signatory countries that would include prominent Germans or English, whichever country was concerned. But then those programs would graduate Fulbrighters, and those Fulbrighters would return to their countries, become teachers or academics, hopefully, and become supporters and potential fundraisers for the exchange program.
And Joan, you were talking about the political context of all of this. At the end of World War II, as the Cold War is emerging, of course, one important political dimension was that after a few years, Germany itself was included in the Fulbright scholarship scheme.
Yes, absolutely, that was correct, and that was part of the reconstruction of Europe financed under the Marshall Plan by the United States. It should also be observed, though, that the early beneficiaries, because that's where that surplus war material was available, were Asia and Europe, which not coincidentally also was the focus of U.S. foreign policy in those years, and that was the building of allies in those regions that had formerly been enemies during the Second World War. And I think it should be noted that so many schemes, the Fulbright included, which require people coming to the host country to study in that country, ultimately brings the funds home because scholarships go to the hosting universities.
Niloufar, you're a recent Fulbright scholar and from Afghanistan. Were you conscious of these foreign policy aims?
Well, first of all, I'm not very recent. It was 2005 to 7, but it's perceived widely in Afghanistan that this scholarship has some political aspect attached to it. My own practical example that I had while going back from the United States to Afghanistan, and I was working with communities, with people. So I really observed the level of change in perception of people about me. And it was a direct statement from people that you are working for the United States. And that's why you see the level of trust really changes, you know. So, yeah, it has its impact on the, especially on the people who are returning back and working in a situation like Afghanistan with such political instability and division right now in the country.
Let's roll back a bit, Niloufar, to when you were applying and what it was like in practice for an aspiring Fulbright scholar. Who did you deal with and how did it work?
I was entirely dealing with the public affairs section of the U.S. Embassy. And the entire process was dealt through them, and officials within the public affairs section of the U.S. Embassy were in direct contact with me in terms of the application process, interviews, exams, and orientation, certainly before departure.
And we shouldn't forget that the Fulbright encompasses all areas of study and covers a broad spectrum of applicants, from students and scholars to teachers and professionals. How typical is that for these sorts of international scholarships, Joan?
I think it's actually quite typical. While we discuss the political context and ramifications, we also shouldn't ignore the educational value of these programs. And I think that the fact that many areas of study are encompassed and a broad spectrum of applicants are accepted in some ways demonstrates the autonomy of the individual grantees, and that's a good thing. A recent study showed that there were nearly 200 programs, scholarship programs, just government-funded programs, in countries around the world. So it's difficult to make any generalizations. One of the challenges in scholarship on international scholarship programs is that there's not even a consistent inventory of what these programs are, and we know relatively little about the characteristics of successful programs, and therefore the study of impact is just emerging fairly recently.
Well, you can study just about any subject, from architecture to zoology, and anyone with an outstanding record or potential can apply, from distinguished professors with an international reputation to local language teachers. And here's one of the early language teacher scholars, Barbara Ailey from the United States, talking to BBC reporter Brian Begg in 1953.
I'm an American exchange teacher under the Fulbright Act.
And what were your first impressions of the English school?
The very first impression was the first day of school when I walked into my first class and all the girls stood up.
They don't do that in America?
No, not in our school anyway.
And how do they dress? Do they have school uniforms?
No uniform.
They come to school in whatever they choose?
Yes, but not usually blue jeans, which is what the English seem to conceive of as the dress for American girls.
So, experience from 1953. Vitoria, you were a language teacher, Fulbright scholar, who went from Brazil to Nebraska, but just a couple of years ago, so clearly a very different time and place. How much of that spirit of curiosity and possibly misconceptions about people in other countries that we just heard there, how much of that was echoed what you found when you went to Nebraska?
Most of my students didn't know a lot about our culture. Nebraska is very far from Brazil, not only geographically, but it's not as exposed to our culture as some other states in America are, like Florida, for example. So they didn't know a lot about us, so there was some curiosity, but most of them were taking my subject. They were taking Portuguese because they needed a second language, or they were just interested in Brazilian music. And as they learned more about us, I just felt like their curiosity about it just started growing a lot. They started researching about it. They started even cooking Brazilian food and bringing it to class. So it was really interesting to see how their curiosity about us grew.
Well, going back to the early days of the Fulbright program, getting people to pay for publicly minded work is never easy, especially in a country that had just spent a lot of resources on fighting a war. So how did Fulbright get round this problem? Here's how Fulbright's second wife, Harriet Mayer Fulbright, recounted it.
Fulbright knew that the majority of his colleagues would not approve of any money spent on such an idea. So the first bill he sent through the Senate outlined an international education exchange program, but made no mention of money needed to make it a reality. As a result, that bill passed easily without any argument. Why should anybody worry about it? Once that was accomplished, he then very nervously searched for a way to pay for it, but did not have to wait long for an answer. Within weeks, coming through the Senate was a proposal to sell to Europe all the war materials left unused all over the continent after the fighting stopped. Fulbright studied the bill and added at the bottom one sentence. The proceeds from these goods shall be limited in use to underwrite the International Education Exchange Program. He sent the bill on without comment, and nobody really read it. It passed easily. This assured the birth of the International Education Exchange Program, which bears his name.
Randall, that sounds almost like subterfuge.
Well, it's just American politics. He was quite clever in that respect. He understood the forces he had to deal with. Actually, there was strong opposition in the House by Representative Jamie Whitten. He had to call on Will Clayton, who was a powerful Assistant Secretary of State for Economic Affairs and did a lot of business in Whitten's district. And Clayton caused Whitten to back down. But that account is essentially true. The concept at that time, Fulbright realized, was revolutionary. And many conservatives in this country regarded it as subversive, would regard it as subversive. Indeed, in the early 1950s, he, against his will, was forced to justify the program as part of the war against communism. Although Fulbright voted against Radio Free Europe and other propaganda agencies. Fulbright, in terms of this politicization, it certainly occurred. But Fulbright fought it every step of the way, particularly in the 1960s. You recall that he became a major opponent of the Cold War, of anti-communism. He was the most important legislative opponent to the war in Vietnam. So I'm not saying that the program didn't serve American national interest, but he was obsessed with limiting the amount of nationalism that was injected into the program.
It's interesting, this, Randall. I mean, it feels as though he's quite a complex man. He changed his view on things from a program which started out, as Joan was saying, with quite an impetus from the Cold War in the post-World War II days. And then here we have him opposing Vietnam by the time you get to the 1960s.
Yes, consistency is the hobgoblin and that sort of thing. He was an early supporter of the Cold War, but he came to see that there was a difference between Khrushchev and Stalin, that the communist world was evolving. And he believed that under the Johnson administration, the administration had been captured by hardline anti-communists, xenophobes, the religious right. You also should know that Mr. Fulbright changed his views on race. He began his public career as a segregationist. He voted for the Southern Manifesto. He opposed the Civil Rights Act of 63 and 64. But like many white Southerners, my parents, for example, he was changed by the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. And by the late 1960s, he had embraced the civil rights movement and was a staunch defender of civil rights legislation. So, yes, he's a very complicated man, a rationalist and a pragmatist, I think.
To get a better idea of William Fulbright, the man, let's hear Harriet Mayor Fulbright again describing a telling incident when a high-level delegation of American politicians arrived at an airport in Costa Rica in the 1960s.
On reaching their destination, there was a good deal of confusion over who should travel to town in which limousine, and the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, namely Fulbright, was inadvertently left behind at the airport. Now, I am sure that there were other vehicles that could have taken him to town had he put up enough of a fuss, but no. He quietly asked for directions and walked the 4 miles to the city. It was exceedingly hot and dusty, but in about an hour, he entered the U.S. Embassy, where he found a pile of baggage belonging to the group. Missing, however, was his briefcase. "Oh," a young Foreign Service officer said when he was asked about it, I locked the briefcase with your confidential papers in the top secret case. For the first time, Fulbright raised his voice. Top secret? You locked my toothbrush and my shaving kit?
Senator Fulbright in Costa Rica in the 1960s. Niloufar, what did you learn about Senator Fulbright and his role in the scholarships when you were on the scheme? Was he someone people talked about?
Well, not really. I mean, we didn't have any type of exposure to this information, especially knowing who Senator Fulbright was and biography, though we had Fulbright enrichment conferences around the country here in the United States during my time. And in the very beginning of the conference, there was a session talking about the senator and his impact on the foreign policy, the foundation of the scholarship, what made him develop such an idea. And I personally heard a lot of, during those time, about his vision for mutual understanding, because Fulbright is considered among all of us as a program that brings culture together. So that aspect was really focused a lot during these enrichment conferences that I attended.
And Vitória, what about Brazil? Was Fulbright an important person for your home country?
In Brazil, we don't know much about Fulbright and we don't hear much about the program. I actually learned more about the program as I was in university and we received a few Fulbright scholars from America there. But I believe the program itself is very important for my country because when I got my scholarship, we had a government that actually cared about education, and they had a lot of science mobility programs, but they didn't have a lot for humanities students, and the Fulbright program could help me accomplish this.
Randall, as such a long-serving chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Fulbright was, of course, involved in lots of legislative battles. But there's one piece of controversial legislation that's partly associated with his name, which just shows how closely domestic economics and international politics can intertwine. It's called the chicken tax legislation. Can you tell us about that and how Fulbright was involved?
He was an ardent supporter of his region and his state's economic interests. You couldn't be reelected. Arkansas is the second largest poultry producing state in the nation. And when the European Union, the Economic Union, attempted to impose a prohibitively high tax on imported poultry, he intervened directly with French and British leaders and used his clout and some sort of veiled threats to have the tax reduced.
Okay, so who knew? Senator Fulbright and the chicken tax.
Yeah.
Well, in 1974, Fulbright was defeated in primary elections for the Democratic Party and left the Senate. After his retirement from politics, he practiced international law at a Washington law firm. He must have been pleased to see his long-standing support for the policy of de-escalation and engagement with America's Cold War enemies bear fruit when countries in the Soviet bloc became free of communism at the end of the 1980s. But what happened to the Fulbright program before and after the Berlin Wall came down in 1989? Joan, fill us in.
Right. I think it's important to remember that the surplus funds from the war commodities eventually ran out. And so a very important change to the legislation establishing the Fulbright was the Fulbright-Hayes Act of 1961. And what that did was establish funding for the program as an annual line item in the federal budget. And that was an important double-edged sword because on one hand, it enabled the U.S. government to expand the program to countries all over the world, but it did subject funding to the political and fiscal dynamics of the budget process. So that brings us now up to the point of another moment of great American triumph, the end of history, as it was rather optimistically called at the time, the fall of the, not only the fall of the Berlin Wall, but the dissolution of the Soviet bloc. And so part of the raison d'etre of the Fulbright and other exchange programs, which was to promote Western interchanges and views during the Cold War period, was also kind of falling apart at that time. And so the Reagan administration came in and proposed to cut the funding. It eventually restored it. And you've seen this kind of up and down pattern. There were cuts in the mid-1990s. this had less to do with Fulbright and more to do with the budget wars of President Clinton at the time and Newt Gingrich, who was leading his crusades in Congress. So I think the critical fact is that the program has endured for all of these years through different kinds of political moments. But the end of the Cold War and the Clinton period that succeeded that was one that, at least from a budget point of view, was more complicated than one would have imagined.
You mentioned the Clinton era. It's interesting that President Bill Clinton was the protege of Senator Fulbright. And when Fulbright died in 1995, it was Clinton who delivered the main eulogy at the funeral service. Here's what he had to say.
He lived with passion, tempered by reason. He loved politics, but cautioned against the arrogance of power. He cherished education as the answer to our common problems and our personal dreams, but he knew there would always be more to learn. He worked for progress and peace, reminding us that the forces of freedom would win the Cold War if we could avoid nuclear war. In a cold dawn only 2 weeks after Hiroshima, calling for the creation of the International Exchange Program that will live as his most profound legacy. Now it includes, as its alumni, Nobel Prize winners, members of Congress, leaders for peace and freedom the world over, and many not so famous people who went home to live out the faith of Senator Fulbright. No matter what their native tongue, all of them are now known by the same name, Fulbrights. In a way, a lot of us here, especially those of us from Arkansas and those who worked for him in other ways over the years, are also, in our own way, Fulbrights. Those of us who knew and loved him, who worked for him, who learned from him, each of us have our indelible memories, some of them serious, some of them quite funny.
Bill Clinton started his political career as a clerk in Fulbright's office, and he always considered Fulbright to be an important mentor. Randall, what were the key areas in which Fulbright influenced Clinton's political thinking?
Well, I think you can see Fulbright's influence in Clinton's stated policy goals, his objectives. He believed that sanctions and military force applied against aggressor nations ought to be multilateral. He believed in globalization. He was a big supporter of the World Bank and structures that transcended that, that made trade and commerce easier across the country. He was non-ideological. Like Fulbright, he believed that anti-communist ideology had been responsible for the intervention into Vietnam. Now, those were his goals. The implementation was sometimes a different matter. The Clinton administration could act unilaterally when it felt it was necessary to protect American strategic and economic interests around the globe. But there are similarities.
Well, after 2001, the 9/11 attacks, the funding for the Fulbright scholarship program increased again. And this is about the time that you applied, Neil Afar. Your background is in women's rights. You set up the first civil society women's NGO in Western Afghanistan. Why did you apply for the scholarship?
Well, there are a couple of reasons I applied. First, because I wanted to do my higher education, my graduate studies. That attracted me a lot. And second, I think we heard a lot during the application process and before that, that it's an exchange program. You will learn a lot from others, and you will learn a lot from United States during the scholarship while you are there. So I think coming from a political science background, that aspect of the program really attracted me to apply for the scholarship.
And was it particularly important for women, the Fulbright scholarship?
Yeah, for women, of course, because in 2002 and 3, soon after the Taliban regime, there was no master's program or graduate program for women in Afghanistan at that time. And there was very small packages started, but not with the scholarship or funding on money. So I think, yes, that was indeed a golden opportunity for women at that time, and still.
Fulbright once said that from a foreign policy perspective, having people who understand your thought is much greater security than another submarine. And it was this understanding of other perspectives which he expanded on in a BBC interview back in 1975.
There's a tendency, with all deference to the media, which you represent, for media to concentrate upon the controversies of life. I mean, that seems to be news. The things where people act in a civilized and sane manner just aren't news. And I think that the misconceptions that grow out of ignorance of other people's and the misconceptions that grow out of media, I mean, out of reporting of actions in other people, create very dangerous attitudes on the part of some people about other people. In other words, to bring an understanding of people from different cultures, different backgrounds, is no way better, I believe, or as good as the exchanges, and especially of people exchanging who later become leaders in their respective communities. The truth of the matter is a great many people who participated in these exchanges have gone back to become influential opinion makers and political leaders, I mean, in the field of journalism, of teaching, and of government, and the professions. And this, I think, when you consider it's been in force only a short time, has had a remarkable effect upon the attitudes of many people. I think this whole idea of détente, as they use it, we use it especially with regard to U.S. and the USSR, but I think I speak of détente with everybody, because it's no sense whatever the human race committing suicide now that they've invented nuclear weapons. And the way to prevent that is exchange, to where people recognize that other people are not devils who have to be eliminated.
It's clear from that for Fulbright, one of the chief merits of the scholarship exchange program he invented was this countering of negative perceptions and changing attitudes. Victoria, you already talked a bit about how that affected you as a Fulbright scholar at the University of Nebraska. Did you feel that you were really changing people's attitudes there, or yourself being changed?
I think that part of what he was saying in this interview, as English teachers, we don't teach only language. We don't teach only foreign language. I think with the foreign language, we also teach culture. And I came to this understanding as I was there in the U.S. So I think, yeah, I changed a lot while I was there.
And I guess today, when there's so much international communication in English, it's more important than ever to focus on the significance of knowing other languages as a way of understanding people.
Fulbright didn't say this, but the reason foreigners have to study in the United States is not so that they'll learn about American culture, not in his mind. It was another way to expose Americans to other cultures. America was, and still is to a certain extent, a very insular country. Travel abroad in the 1940s and 50s was limited to an elite. And the idea was that Americans would go abroad and learn about other cultures, and people from foreign lands would come to the U.S. and maybe learn something about the U.S., but mainly expose more Americans to foreign cultures. He was appalled in the early 1960s when the Moscow Ballet came to the U.S. and had to perform in a fire trap of a theater in Washington, D.C. He regarded the U.S. as, quite frankly, culturally retarded.
If one steps back and tries to look at it more broadly, there is another way of seeing it. So the Fulbright scholarship was born soon after a number of very different countries joined together to find Nazism. And you could argue that today, even though the world's much more connected than it was in the 1940s, we still don't seem to be any better at thinking and acting collectively for the common good. So, Randall, I wondered, as a historian, do you think that this suggests that the impact of schemes like Fulbright are maybe not so great when it comes to the bigger picture of how politics is conducted?
I couldn't agree with you more. Sadly, it's made little or no difference. Despite Fulbright's desires, the Cold War played out from 45 to 90. There was no direct conflict between the U.S. and the communist bloc, but many, many, many proxy wars. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, the problem has not been so much interstate conflict, but ethnic and religious conflict. I don't think I hate to say this, I love the program in international exchange. I'm an educator. I don't think it's probably made any difference in international politics at all. And I think Fulbright, in my interviews with him, said that he had expected, really, that it would change international politics. He could enumerate for you every Japanese foreign minister, every Brazilian parliamentarian who had had a Fulbrighter. And he was immensely proud of the program, but for cultural and educational reasons, not because it changed international politics.
Joan, there's another criticism that's sometimes leveled at scholarships of this sort. Their focus on the successful candidates being potential leaders, and a worry that is this just a smokescreen for elites to perpetuate their grip on power through having access to this sort of programme, and that they're already part of an elite and then they reconfirm themselves as part of an elite?
Actually, one of the interesting aspects of doing research on international scholarships more generally is that we lack any kind of really sound socioeconomic data on the beneficiaries. All we can do is kind of surmise that since there is an opportunity cost in accepting a scholarship, you're not at home working and supporting your family, and it requires, since all of them require a high level of academic competitiveness, they do tend to favor people with resources or people who have excelled academically, which in most cases, not all, depends on a high level of prior schooling. So in practice, unless one, as the designer of a program, and there are many programs that try to break this cycle of advantage by reaching out specifically to marginalized groups or populations that have not enjoyed access to higher education, unless one does that explicitly, yes, programs do tend to favor existing elites. But we have many programs in the United States. A very large and significant one is funded by the Gates Foundation, called the Gates Millennial Scholars Program. This kind of dwarfs the Fulbright funding. It's a $16 billion program. It's directed expressly at support for undergraduates from U.S. minorities, precisely to try to break this cycle of educational disadvantage.
There is another concern about these international scholarships, isn't there? And Niloufar, this is a question for you, because you're no longer in Afghanistan. You're talking to us from Washington. Does selecting people, the brightest and the best from a society, does it actually encourage a brain drain that people leave and then they don't go back?
Well, not really in terms of Fulbright, because Fulbright had the requirement. We all came through a J-1 visa, and J-1 visa means you have to go back to your country, whatever country you're coming from. So in my time, 100% of students went back. I was in Kabul. I worked there the whole time. And I just came in 2014 back for doing another degree because I love education in the United States. So,
but that's the point, isn't it? That people may go back because they're required to by the program, but they don't necessarily stay back.
Well, most of them stay back at this point that I have seen. I mean, I accept when the security really, really gets back. It's not only about only Fulbrighters, but anyone who has access to go outside the country, they are leaving the country when the security is really, really not under control, especially at Kabul level. But in terms of Fulbright, of me dealing directly with my classmates and our cohort, I think most of the students are back in Kabul and they are working.
And finally, Randall, how close do you think the scholarship today is to Fulbright's original vision?
Well, I think he'd be quite satisfied with it. I think he'd be delighted with it. Politics aside, he learned to really sort of glory in the experiences of Fulbrighters. He spent his last years traveling to every exchange country that he could and talking to Fulbrighters here. And in the end, I think that the lack of political change, he accepted that and embraced the cultural and educational benefits.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. My thanks to all four of you, Professors Joan Darson and Randall Woods, and recent Fulbright scholars Victoria Prochet and Niloufar Saki. And thanks to all of you who've been listening. Let's give the final word to William Fulbright.
I have felt as I travel in so many other countries, as I have been traveling, that the smaller countries, not so bemused by their power and size and illusions of grandeur, have taken this program very seriously. And I have felt and still feel that the people of all who participate in this, who need its effects more than any other, happen to be the United States. And I'm very pleased that twice as many foreign students have come here as Americans have gone abroad, because we need it more than anybody else. And we need it not only in that cultural sense, but because we are large, powerful, and potentially dangerous, we need to be civilized and humanized more than anyone else.